everyone, and welcome to another episode of Rockin' Retrospect. I'm your host, Nick Bambeck. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest, a music journalist and educator, Scott Heisel. How's it going, Scott?
It's going very well. Thanks for having me here. I appreciate it.
No problem. I first contacted Scott because he wrote a piece about a month ago about his assessment of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Class of 2022 nominees. And I was really intrigued by Scott's piece because it was very provocative, to say the least, of some of the opinions of some of the artists. And I am always intrigued by different perspectives of the Rock and Roll Fame because I run a blog that exclusively almost follows the Rock and Roll Fame, and also this podcast. Even though it's not entirely about the Rock Hall, we do eventually talk about it at some point in each episode. So I was really intrigued by your interest in the Rock and Roll Fame, because that was like the first thing I remember seeing that you wrote about the Hall. Sure. What is your familiarity with like the Rock Hall world in terms of like writing about it or things like that?
Yeah, well, so I live in Cleveland, Ohio. I moved here in 2004 after I graduated college because I got a job as an editor at Alternative Press, which is was a national music monthly. I haven't worked there for about 8 years now. I believe it's still in existence in some kind of zombified capacity. But when I moved here in 2004, I was working for them, and that was a kind of like the pop punk and emo boom. So when you had American Idiot by Green Day, then you had your Newfound Glories and Fall Out Boys and Mike Hems and all that kind of stuff. So I was kind of along for the ride for that. So I knew about the Rock Hall before I came to Cleveland, but I'd never been there as a sort of, in terms of a physical presence. And then within like the first couple weeks of me living here, I was like, I have to go to this thing, because even at 22, and even knowing that the museum and Hall of Fame was so focused on like classic rock, which a lot of which I don't have much of an interest in, it's still the only thing, the only kind of institution, whether it be virtual or reality, that honors this dumb thing that I've dedicated my whole life to, right? You know, three chords. And so I've been very familiar over the past 18 years since I've lived in Cleveland. I've gone there countless times. I've been a card-carrying member a number of years in a row. I've gone to induction ceremonies when they've been in Cleveland. When I worked for AP, we did a lot of partnership stuff with the Rock Hall. I shot videos there, all sorts of stuff. So In terms of the actual like physical space, I've been there quite a bit over the years. In terms of like the overarching kind of ephemeral nature of what is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, like a boardroom in New York City, I think a lot of those people need to be put out to pasture, but that's a conversation for another time. So
as someone from New York, No, I'm joking. I'm always intrigued by the Rock Hall because it feels like an imperfect institution in many ways, like What it's trying to be, its mission or its goals or motives. And it just, there's something about that, even though sometimes I do get frustrated by it as well, I'm always just intrigued by it as time goes on. And now they're changing leadership and their, I guess, calls for more of a diverse musical class in terms of like style, like not even like race and gender, but really like now they're kind of being all encompassing in many ways. Like this,
right? They're really making everyone say to themselves, what is rock and roll? Which honestly, I think that's cool. I think it's a good way to generate discussion, because rock and roll is not just guitar. Rock and roll is not just, you know, a 1-4-5 chord progression, right? Rock and roll is more than just those things. So absolutely, I don't have an issue with like the sonic diversity per se. I have a lot of other issues. How much time do you got?
Oh, I have all day, Scott. Yeah. I could talk to the best of them about the Rock Hall.
Yeah.
But your piece really intrigued me, and I felt like I had to contact this guy because I looked at your bio and I looked at your website, and I was like, this guy has been around the block and I feel like you'd be an ideal guest for this podcast. And before we get started, I'm just going to tell you a really quick side note that I don't think you might know. I was actually mentioned in Alternative Press about two or three years ago. Yes, because there's a whole thing about Tom Morello. He has his SiriusXM show, One Man Revolution. And what happened was he doesn't have where it has like just, you know, like it written down like what he says. But a lot of things he'll say about the Rock Hall because he's on the nominating committee. And he's been a nominee several times with Rage Against the Machine. And I would type up on Twitter, like, you know, like what he wrote, like verbatim. And he had an episode that was about the 2020 nominees when they were announced for the fall of 2019 for induction the next year when they did that. And I got randomly texted by a few people like, oh, you might want to check this out. And I was like in like a few articles that they wrote, and I was just like kind of astounded. Mm-hmm. And then he actually retweeted them himself, Morello. So it was so bizarre. So It's cool that you mentioned alternative presses somewhere you worked. Today, we're going to be talking about an alternative rock band of the 1990s, pretty iconic one. And I don't even think they're 1990s, personally. They're just all-encompassing because you could see them in the 21st century. And I think that's where they've been the most popular, in my opinion. And that's Weezer.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I'll do the W here. I know it's an audio medium, but I'm doing the W, Weezer. So, yes. Weezer is my favorite band of all time. I also hate Weezer. And I think to be Pat Wilson, the drummer of Weezer, once said in alternative press, mind you, he said that to be a true Weezer fan, you have to hate Weezer. And I think that any longtime fan of the band, we're talking decades or more, will agree with that statement for sure. So.
When you said that, as soon as you said that, I thought of that Saturday Night Live sketch where they had Leslie.
I'm familiar with the SNL sketch. Yeah, I was actually in LA when that aired, and I was at a show, and all of a sudden my phone just starts, because you know I'm in LA, it's 3 hours behind, right? Because I'm in Pacific time at that point, and all of a sudden all my East Coast friends are texting me, "Are you watching this? Are you watching this? Did you see this?" And they're not saying what it is, but I'm getting like all these texts. I'm like, "What are you guys talking about?" They're like, "You got to see this. They did a Weezer sketch." I'm like, "You're kidding me, right?" And I text the band's manager, who I've known for a long time. And I was like, "Did you know about this?" He's like, "We kind of heard that something might be happening," but he didn't know until it aired either. And like that thing that took over that the next morning, as I like scrolled through social media, that reaffirmed to me that that's the bubble in which I am ensconced, is the Weezer bubble, because that's all anybody was talking about on my social media feeds. It was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. And for listeners that may not be familiar, there was a very infamous sketch from, I think, 2018, right? Like,
yes, 2018. Yeah.
Yeah. And basically, it was
2019, actually.
2019. It was very recent.
It was 20 something. It was before the pandemic. Who knows what time is anymore? Yeah.
It was like 10 years ago at this rate, the rate we're going right now.
1994. Yes.
But it was basically at this Thanksgiving dinner, essentially, that they're just arguing about what is the best Weezer album. It was like Matt Damon was the host. And it's just funny because I feel like that perfectly encapsulates a band as polarizing as Weezer, where like people just have a reaction to them for good or bad. And that's why when I asked Scott to be on the show and he mentioned Weezer, I immediately said yes, because this is a band that I think they're way more influential and way better than a lot of people give them credit for. I think they're a very important band.
All that thing. And they're also way worse than people think they are too. They are all encompassing. They are the Ouroboros that just eats its own tail, right? Like everything you're saying is true. And then some.
Thank you. How did you first become interested in Weezer?
Oh gosh, MTV. You know, I'm a child of the 90s. You know, I'm an aging millennial. And it was MTV. It was hearing or seeing the music videos for Buddy Holly, seeing the music video for the Sweater song, just on repeat forever and ever and ever. And I remember seeing those first two. I was 12 years old when those were out. And I remember not understanding. I knew that the Buddy Holly music video had all this Happy Days footage in there, right?
Right.
But I had a really hard time understanding if the members of the band on stage in that video were also Weezer. I couldn't figure it out because they look so different from the Sweater song video, especially Rivers. Rivers had this big bowl, shaggy bowl haircut and glasses in the Sweater song video. And then he's all styled up for the Buddy Holly video. And I'm like, what? Is this the same band? It was so confusing, right? So that was my first exposure to them. And then I remember I borrowed the Blue Album on CD from a friend of mine I went to school with, listened to it all the time. It wasn't until a few years later that I really got into Weezer. It was when Pinkerton had come out and already flopped. And I had seen the video for El Scorcho maybe once or twice on MTV. And so now we're a couple years past that. It's like 1998 or something like that. And I'm in a band with a friend of mine, and we're driving to a show that we're about to play or something. And she goes, "Oh, have you heard the new Weezer album that came out the other year?" I said, "No, I only know the Blue Album." She goes, "Oh, let me put on Pinkerton for you." She puts on Pinkerton. And that was just like that a game changer. That was probably my junior or senior year of high school. And that was it. And that the rest of my life thus far has been dedicated to seeking out the same sort of emotional catharsis I got from that record the first time I heard it. So this is the dragon that I am chasing.
Yeah, that those two albums, they're just, I think, one of the two best album streaks ever. Like, I'll take that back. The three albums, because I think the 2001 one is also really great as well. I think that's among the best three album streaks, I think, in the modern era. Like, I mean, it's pretty iconic at some of those songs, but I just love that people keep going back to Pinkerton and rediscovering why it's such an important album and why I think critical reassessments are so important for albums like that. Because, yeah, they didn't, maybe people didn't understand it in 1996 or accept it, but now it feels like every year it just keeps getting more and more acclaim. Because the Blue Album is like one of the best debut albums, and like so many classics on that one album. It reminds me of like the Cars in many ways, in that sense, where like the Cars had like 10 songs like for that first album. It's like a greatest hits. Like you could just play it and go. And I feel like that's the same way with the Blue Album, because my first experience with Weezer was also Buddy Holly, because I was born in like the late 80s. So I was born in actually 89. And throughout the 90s, they always had like Happy Days and like those reruns. And I remember seeing a music video for Buddy Holly, and I thought it was an episode of Happy Days, to be quite honest. I didn't realize that. And then I was like, oh, it's a band. And then it was such an inventive music video that Spike Jonze, who became a really big film director later on, and he's one of those directors like David Fincher, who got his start doing music videos. And Buddy Holly was the first one. And then I just kind of always been intrigued by them because they're so subversive and playful and catchy songs that they wrote. So yeah, it goes back to Buddy Holly for me, at least. So I'm glad to hear that for you too.
I'd say most people that, you know, and there's probably still legitimately tens of thousands of people who think that Weezer is from Kenosha, Wisconsin, because of that music video in the Kenosha, Wisconsin zone. And I guarantee you, people are like, oh, they're from Wisconsin, because why would they lie, right? So it's one of those little things that kind of lives on. And I still, to this day, the end of that video where the band's walking out and Al says, oh, you know, did you try the fish? And Matt Sharp says, not so good, Al. I literally on my phone have a GIF of that I use with alarming frequency. It's one of my favorite random things to quote, because if you know what it is, it's an instant friendship. It's like, oh, we're in the same tribe. We both didn't date a lot in high school. Cool. Let's hang out and talk about Weezer. Right. Here we go.
I love that last line. That's one of my favorites from any music video, because it's just that you remember that.
Yeah.
But no one knows how the fish was. I'm assuming that you've seen Weezer in concert.
Countless times. I think I have I'm outing myself. I have a spreadsheet that I keep where I track every Weezer song I've seen, because the biggest problem with Weezer is that they have so many songs and only play so few of them, because they very much are, generally speaking, a greatest hits band at this point in their career, and they have been for a long time, which endlessly frustrating. But every once in a while, you get kind of a random deep cut or B-side or gem, and I have a spreadsheet tracking every single song I've ever heard, every single show I've seen them at. I think I'm in 20-somethings at this point. I didn't see them until 2001, so I never saw them in the Blue or Pink era. I was too young to go see them, and then they took the hiatus for a number of years. I didn't see them until they were doing their pre-release tour for the Green Album in 2001, and it was amazing.
Yeah, that's crazy, because you didn't see them in the Matt Sharp era. That's like the first two albums.
Don't remind me. It kills me that I never got to see that. I've seen the Rentals with Matt Sharp, which are also a great band, but I've never seen Matt play with Weezer. And God damn it, get him in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and put Matt on the stage. I want to see it. I'll travel anywhere in the world to see Matt Sharp play with Weezer.
Oh, me too. I think, I don't know, I'm really intrigued if that happens for them. But yeah, it's funny, because I've never seen Weezer in concert, because just never worked out. Like, they've always played in New York or North Carolina or wherever I lived, but the timing never worked out. But I was supposed to see them, ironically, at the 2020 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony, because they were supposed to be the house band. And and it wasn't really said until after the fact, like you kind of found out through the grapevine, but that would have been kind of incredible for their, at least like stock in the Rock Hall of Fame to go up, because they're a weird band to never be associated with the Rock Hall, like inducting people. I don't think Rivers has ever inducted anyone. And that's so strange because he's a pretty good talker.
So the year, well, that's debatable, but I've interviewed him a number of times. But the year before 2019, when the car, were the cars 2019 or 2018?
2020, I'm sorry, 2018.
Okay, so 2018, Scott Schreiner from Weezer played bass with the Cars.
Oh, right, he did.
The induction. So that was the first time Weezer crossed over. And so I was thinking, oh, cool. Like now they're going to kind of think about Weezer. And that was right at the point where they were going to be, they could be eligible like a year later. Right. And so then you had like, they were lined up for the 2020 ceremony to be like the house band of like playing everyone's music. I'm like, cool. We're setting the table. Finally, my boys get their shine next year. And then it's no. and we're still trying to get the MC5 in. Okay. All right. So I, again, you know, if we're talking, I have so many thoughts.
I'm just disappointed. But now if they do come, I'm going to try to make it a point to see Weezer, because I think they're one of those bands, like I was saying before, you just take them for granted and you just think like, oh, who are these like nerdy guys almost? Because that's how I always perceive them at first. But so many wonderful songs. And yeah, at this point, they're probably a greatest hits band, but they probably have to be because that's...
They got a lot of great hits. I mean, it's the curse of writing a lot of really good songs over a long career is that people want to hear them. So you're going to keep playing the sweater song for the 10,000th time, even though you have a catalog of 500 more songs that are just as good.
It just can't be undone. No, I'm joking. Yeah. So what makes you a fan of this band?
I think what got me into them as a fan, you know, I discovered their music, you know, and liked it. And then when I went to college, my freshman year of college, is the first time I got high-speed internet. You know, at home, I was always on dial-up and all kind of stuff. This is 2000. This is how long ago this was. I'm dating myself quite a bit. And that was right when Weezer was starting to come out of their hibernation. They had gotten a new bass player named Mikey Welsh, and they had kind of the past couple of years of like darkness had kind of started to fall away. And they did like a really small club tour. They did like a run on the Warp tour in the fall of 2000. And their fan base was, as the people say nowadays, extremely online, right? That's Weezer's fans. It's a lot of people like me who are just a little bit left of center, a little bit nerdy, a little bit maybe introverted or not as like we're not the jocks, we're not the whatever it is, right? And so I think that part of my generation gravitated toward the internet really, really quickly and embraced it. And a lot of us like Weezer. And so going to Weezer.net, which was a fan page and then became their official website, was a huge part of it. And Carl Koch, their kind of unofficial fifth member slash kind of band historian and videographer, had an exhaustive history of the band on their website. He treated the band as if they were the most important band of all time, documenting every single recording session, every single demo, every single tour date. And it was all in the rear view, right? Because the band wasn't doing anything at that point. And you can just spend hours reading this recording history and reading all this stuff and all these little tidbits of information, like who inspired these songs or that kind of stuff, because so much of those first two albums were extremely autobiographical. And so you just kind of felt this deepening connection with a frontman who had then been extremely reclusive because the world at large rejected his big kind of coming out as this like, you know, soul-bearing person with Pinkerton, right? And so that all just kind of lined up to me with someone who was already getting pretty into second wave emo bands like the Get Up Kids and the Promise Ring and Braid, and really quickly figuring out that Pinkerton was an emo record. Whether they knew that or not, that's what they made, right? And it really fit into that second wave of emo. And so that's what got me in, was the fact that I had never heard someone so rich and famous as they were at that point in their career after the Blue Album sold 3 million copies. Be that open and honest and sad. It didn't happen with Nirvana that same way. Nirvana obviously were huge when they made In Utero, but they doubled down on the aggression and doubled down on the how many buttons can we push to really aggravate people, you know, calling your song Rape Me and stuff like that. They were more of a punk rock band, right?
Right.
And Rivers wasn't. Rivers is not a punk rock guy. He's just a songwriter. And he was really struggling being a 20-something guy in college. He went back to college after the Blue Album was huge, right? And he couldn't meet a girl. He couldn't make any friends, right? And like, that's something that I could relate to. And so to see this rock star this ostensibly rock star who's won VMAs and sold millions of records just be like, this sucks. My life sucks. Who can't relate to that? You know? So I think that's where a lot of Weezer's poor diehards came from, was just a bunch of nerds like me. And, you know, and then ever since then, it's like the deeper you get into Weezer, there's just so many layers of weirdness that have happened. And you learn about all of these songs that Rivers had written over the years that never saw the light of day or just got leaked out on a weird demo tape or whatever. And there's so many incredible little 3-minute gems. And you're like, what other band has this level of depth to be explored? And I don't know of any other modern band that has someone who is as prolific as Rivers is. That's my opinion.
And something that I think that for me speaks about the band is their album covers. I know it sounds silly to go to the album covers, but if you think about like even like the Blue album or a lot of their albums, really, like even the Green album, you see just these four average looking guys and they're unkempt hair, they're wrinkly clothes. They're just, you can relate to them just because of their image and their look. And you could tell there's nothing too glamorous about these guys. And yeah. I feel like that's part of what always drew me to Weezer. Cause I even wrote about that because I did like a top 100 Rock Hall prospects project and I had Weezer on the list. And I focused on that because I just was thinking you can't get past that fact. But I think that's why so many people like them is because there's just something that we can relate to them.
And that, like, that also drove their career for the first 5 records in that
right.
Literally the reason they went back to putting themselves on the cover on the Green album was because Pinkerton bombed and it's like, well, right. What worked for the first time around? We get Rick Ocasek back. Okay, check. We have really just, you know, catchy pop songs. Okay, no depth, just check, right? We do a photo of the four of us on the cover, check. Okay, right. And then they do Maladroit after Green album, an album I love, has a weird cover, kind of in a strange record, didn't do as well, right? Take a couple years off, come back for Make Believe. What do? Throw the four guys on the cover again, right? Like it's been this kind of constant. Mm-hmm. It's like every time Spider-Man gets rebooted in the theater, you know what I mean? But it's like, it's same with Weezer. Like, okay, we're rebooting Weezer. This is the return to form. Like that's what they treated their image as. If you saw their photo on a cover of an album, that was meant to be, this is the one that you're going to want to pick up. The other one's not so much. This is the one you want, right? And all mm-hmm. their best-selling albums are ones that have their faces on the cover. So it's they're not wrong.
It's so funny that you say it because that's something I thought of too, was like when they try to be more artistic or they want to be more expressing themselves, it doesn't work out. So it's just really interesting that you also pointed that out because I was thinking that it's just such a weird coincidence how that played out. We've been talking a little bit about Weezer's history, but let's talk about their formation for a few minutes. How did this band get started?
Hair metal. It's all hair metal. Yes. For real. Rivers was in a band called Avant Garde, which was this weird, like, kind of a proggy metal band in the 80s. He had long hair, like, down to his waist, you know, full on whatever. And he moved out to L.A. from Connecticut to be in this band. And the band kind of morphed into a more of a pop metal band called Zoom. These bands were just trying to work the Sunset Strip. And, you know, in that time period where Poison and all his bands were blowing up and they never really got anywhere. And as he literally sings about in the song Heart Songs on the Red album, he literally sings about working at Tower Records and Nevermind by Nirvana comes out. And he's like, what the fuck is this? Because he just listened to metal his whole life, pretty much, you know, and his favorite band is Kiss, as Rivers' favorite band, right? So he wants this big bombastic stuff. And to see it presented in a way that's just the complete antithesis of that and literally kills off the scene that he's trying to become a part of, that's what says, oh, maybe I could like do something here. You know, like I know I can shred, but like, can I write a song? And that's where it started. And so their first practice was notoriously on Valentine's Day in 1992, which sums it up perfectly, right? Like these are four dudes who don't have a girlfriend or whatever. And they get together on Valentine's Day to jam for the first time, right? And that was when it was Rivers Cuomo, their original guitar player, Jason Cropper, the original bass player, Matt Sharp, and then their drummer, Pat Wilson. And that was a start. And they were gigging around LA for the first year or so, they never really recorded anything. Nothing ever came out before they got signed, right? They just weren't those bands that were in the trenches playing the LA clubs, trying to get noticed, you know, playing Club Lingerie and Club Dump and opening for Dog Star with Keanu Reeves, just trying to like play the game, right? But the people who got them. Like the notoriously their fans, Michael and Carly, who they wrote a song about, became like their number one and number two fans. Like they were the first people to discover the band and they were huge supporters of them. And so that's kind of where they got the motivation to keep going with. They were connecting with people on this like deep level in their local kind of LA scene, which was super hyper competitive in the rise of all of grunge, right? It's like, what are we all going to do? Metal's dying off. Grunge is happening, but we're not really a grunge band. And some of the early Weezer stuff has some grunge overtones to it. And Rivers kind of sings with that kind of like, it's a good thing he got rid of it. There's some really rare YouTube footage of Weezer playing like with Jason Cropper still in the band, with Rivers has long hair. Like it's really unnerving to see. You're like, whoa, they're playing like My Name is Jonas, but like they look like they're Heshers. It's crazy. And so they kind of got their image figured out a little bit and they got signed in 93. And they made the Blue album. They went to New York City and recorded with Rick Ocasek. He was the first person they wanted to work with. They wanted to self-produce. And the label's like, nope, you have to work with somebody. So they're like, well, we like the Cars. And so they recorded a cover of Just What I Needed and sent it to Rick Ocasek. And he's like, okay, cool. You guys, I'll record with you guys. So they went out to New York City, recorded the record. In the middle of the record, they kick out Jason Cropper, the rhythm guitar player, because it just wasn't really kind of vibing. And Jason Cropper had a girl back home and they were having a baby and it just wasn't kind of lining up. So they give him the boot. They bring in Brian Bell the last minute, but there's not enough time for him to record guitar on the record. So Rivers plays every single guitar part on the Blue Elm. All Brian Bell does is some backing vocals here and there. And then he poses for the cover photo. So the really, the Blue Album is just a three-piece band, if you really think about it. It's pretty much just Rivers and Pat and Matt. And allegedly, Rivers wrote all the parts for everybody else, too. There's a couple songs on Blue that were co-written with Pat Wilson, notably The World Has Turned and Left Me Here, and I can't remember the other one. I'm going to punch myself for not remembering it. And then My Name is Jonas has a writing credit to Jason Cropper because he wrote the little finger-picked intro. But other than that, it's the Rivers show. And that set the stage for the next 15 years of Weezer. That's kind of how they formed it, where they got to where they go. And then the album came out in May of 94, a month after Kurt Cobain killed himself. And it's this weird moment where you wonder if Kurt, like I think Rivers always wondered if Kurt would have liked Weezer because he'd never heard Weezer. You know, they weren't anybody until the album came out. And you just kind of wonder like what would have happened if their worlds would have ever collided. Because I think that there's a huge part of Rivers who just wanted to do that. Just write these super simple Beatles-esque pop songs with just heavy distortion. That's what Nirvana was at its best. And that's kind of where Weezer grabbed that mantle and ran with it.
Absolutely. And I think you brought up a really good point about their popularity. And also their first album came out right after Kurt Cobain's death. So it's really interesting when you look at alternative rock at this moment where you had like Green Day and you had Weezer and you had a lot of acts that followed but that weren't quite grunge, even though like they kind of sort of followed like this power pop influenced sound and they were somewhat punk, but Weezer is not really a punk band. Like you could see some of the bands that maybe were influenced that were punk on Weezer, but they're not really more indebted to punk as, say, like Green Day or even like a band who was before Nirvana, which was like Nine Inch Nails or someone like Soundgarden or bands like that that were kind of emerging right at this moment too. But yeah, I always wonder that too, like how much of that also helped them in a way because there's like they're kind of like filling a void.
Yeah, I think people, you know, I love Nirvana, but at the time when Kurt Cobain died, I wasn't like obsessed. My older brother, he was, right? That was my older brother's band. And then Weezer became my band, right? Like there was such a large shadow cast over rock and roll in the wake of Kurt dying. And everyone's like, well, we can't, like, this is so just incomprehensibly sad that he took his own life and all this had to happen. That everyone was just like, what do we do? And literally it was Green Day and Weezer who filled that void of like, we need something that's fun, right? And Weezer's fun, but that first album is just as dark lyrically and really sad at points, right? There are some really happy songs in that record, but "If the World Has Turned and Left Me Here," for example, is just a heartbreaking song, or "No One Else" is like this almost hilarious song about how shitty Rivers is to people. And he just kind of admits how he's shitty, right? And mm-hmm. So there's a lot of these moments and everyone's like, "Oh, who cares? It's fun. The workers are going home. My name is Jonas, blah, blah, blah." Like people just kind of go with it. And they're like, "Oh, they're being ironic." Weezer has never been ironic. They don't understand what irony is. If you see Rivers doing or saying something, he's not ever taking the piss out of it. He wholeheartedly is committed to being whatever that weird thing is at that moment. So it's just important to keep that in mind.
I actually had a follow-up question to ask you. How did they get their name Weezer?
As I've always heard, that it came as a nickname from Rivers' dad named Frank. Frank Cuomo was his dad. And that he gave him the nickname because he had asthma or had a hard time breathing when he was a kid. And like allegedly, that's where the name comes from. I think that story has been told and then also kind of recanted a few times over the years. There's not really a deeper meaning to it as like most band names. Most band names don't mean jack squat when you look into it. True. You know what I mean? Or they mean something really, really profane like Pearl Jam. You're like, "Oh, cool. That's gross." You know what I mean? So Google that or don't, I guess, whatever you want to do. So
yeah, I heard that too. And I was like, I didn't know if that was 100% true, but it's a name probably. That sticks though. Like yeah. It sounds catchy, but also like you don't forget someone named Weezer either. Like yeah. It's hard to explain, mm-hmm. but
that's the story that's always gone around. And it's part of the reason why I think they got a lot of shit early on from people thought they were just like a corporate version of Pavement, you know, the same kind of thing, like right. slacker rock, like wearing like untucked shirts, you know, kind of messy hair. Their band name is two syllables. Everything's lowercase. Like it just felt like they were just being like, whatever. Right. But that's just the aesthetic that they took and ran with, you know? So they're way better than Pavement. Sorry, Pavement. Pavement's never written a song as good as Weezer's best songs ever. So I'll say that on the record.
I don't know if Pitchfork would like that. No, I'm kidding.
Pitchfork can fuck right off. Can I swear on this podcast? Sorry.
No, I'm joking.
Oh, no. All right. Pitchfork is, I have many opinions on Pitchfork. That's a popular
thing. We could, I actually complain to friends all the time about their rated system and assessments. It always frustrates me, and I'm not a huge Pitchfork fan, but some people live and die with it, which I feel bad for those people. We talked about Kiss and the Cars being influential to Weezer's sound. Who are some other bands that also you think inspired Weezer?
Yeah, definitely Kiss and the Cars. Kiss for sure is the hugest influence on Rivers growing up. I think all the band kind of related to that. Like Van Halen was a huge one for Pat Wilson. You look at like what kind of helped them find their sound was definitely the Cars and definitely Nirvana and definitely Pixies. Those three bands, I think, really, you can distill down Weezer's first 3-4 years as a band from 92 to 96. It's like they exist because of the Cars and the Pixies and Nirvana. And it's always kind of like the ball is rolling toward one of those corners of the triangle at any given point, right? And when it's right in the middle, you get the Blue Album. And when it's a little too close to Nirvana, you're going to get Pinkerton, right? Mm-hmm. But it's always kind of just rolling around this little thing.
Yeah. Those are definitely some bands that I think definitely influenced Weezer. I'm going to throw a few out there, too, that I would love to hear your take on. The Beach Boys, because like that pop.
Oh, sure.
That pop Absolutely. Intuition that like Brian Wilson had. I feel like Rivers is kind of in that spirit. I also think Cheap Trick is an influence because of the power.
Oh, because Mia Moore. I love Cheap Trick. I'm from their hometown. I know all their kids.
Are you for real?
I love Cheap Trick. They're in my mind, not to get off track here, they are the last great American rock and roll band. There is no there's no band with more longevity that kicks as much ass as Cheap Trick. They are phenomenal.
That's a top five all-time band for me. It's like, if you get it, you love them and everything they do. I just love Cheap Trick with all my heart.
I knew too. I liked you. I knew I liked you. There you go. Cheap Trick is the greatest. But yeah, still. But
I also thought like Elvis Costello, like with the wordplay. And then because they did an album basically like Van Halen, you can kind of hear those heavy guitar sounds.
Yeah.
And then one I thought, because you wrote about it recently, was Devo. That was a band I kept thinking about with comparing them to Weezer, because they're kind of quirky, a little off center sometimes with their image. But they're always, I would say, restless spirits when it comes to music, like, right? Like what they're exploring in their, you know, music and the lyrics. And I don't know, that was another band. I just was like, I wonder if
Devo. Those are really interesting comparisons. I certainly, some of those I think would work for sure. And I'm sure individual members of Weezer's core would say, oh yeah, I love that better, that band. But with Rivers, people, I think, and this is kind of an odd take, I think he's a genius, but also I think he gets a lot of credit for accidents. I don't think he had probably ever heard Devo in 1992. I don't think he had probably had any knowledge of like underground. He just didn't. He was a metalhead. He was listening to Ozzy. He was listening to Randy Rhoads, right?
Yeah.
And it's by happenstance that he like discovered Nirvana and then just realized, oh, I have this thing that I'm good at. You know, so since then, I think it's been a lifelong game of catch up for him, where it's like, who is writing the best pop songs of all time? I need to learn these songs, right? The Beach Boys are a good example. He did a great demo of Don't Worry Baby early on in his career when he was like demoing songs for the Blue album. It's a great demo that's on one of his solo albums, kind of a solo compendium. So I'm sure he got into the Beach Boys at some point. I think the people want to like retrofit on influences to Weezer specifically. And when we say Weezer, we really mean Rivers, because he wrote essentially everything, right? When you hear the early demos for those songs on the Blue album, they are as you hear them on the record, even though he played everything on them, right? So I'm sure Matt Sharp would say, oh, I loved Gary Numan, right? Or whoever, but like, did that make it to the record? You know, and it really didn't. It was very much what Rivers heard. And he just heard this pot, you know, this kind of mashup of whatever it was. So yeah, I've never really heard anyone say Devo or Cheap Trick before. Two bands who are great, and one band is in the Rock Hall, the other one should be in the Rock Hall. And I'm sure that Rivers knew what Whippet was, right? But like, I don't think to this day, I wonder if he's ever heard like Are We Not Meant? Probably not. Brian Bell notoriously knows nothing about music. And yet he knows everything. Like, he knows everything too. Brian Bell, the guitar player, is a genius musician as well. But like, when they did their Teal album a couple of years ago, a bunch of like cover songs, he said he had never heard, keep in mind, he said he had never heard the song Mr. Blue Sky by Electric Light Orchestra before. That is fucking mind blowing to be in. At that point, it was what, 2019, I think is when it came out, or 2018. How? It'd been out for 50 years.
I think it was in one of those Marvel movies.
It's been everywhere. It was in a commercial. It was like, how is that possible? How have you never heard Mr. Blue Sky? By the time you're like 50 years old, it's insane, right? So I think Weezer's fans try to impart all this stuff on them in hopes of like making their own fandom make more sense. Like, oh, well, I like these bands and I like Weezer, so these have to be all connected. But like, it's just not that simple. It's so much of Weezer's appeal is the fact that there's no other band that they sound like or band that sounds like them that nails it, right? They are iconoclastic in that way, right? Which is why, to me, they're still relevant 30 years on, because they never have made the same album twice. Mm-hmm. And they still somehow, scraping and clawing, have managed to stay relevant with young people. Every single decade, I mean, I teach students at School of Rock. That's what I do for a living now. I teach music at School of Rock. And 12-year-olds know who Weezer is. 18-year-olds know who Weezer is. Yep. 6-year-olds know who Weezer is. Like, it's just there. It's in the air, right? And there's no other band from the 90s, except for Green Day, who can do that. You know what I mean? Like, who is that saturated in everything?
Yeah, I totally agree. Because I feel like what's really great about Weezer is you're saying they're all encompassing with all age groups, but also music fans. Like, I always hear people who like metal or who like different types of music that also really enjoy Weezer, or at least know their songs and their existence. And yeah, to me, them and then the Foo Fighters and Weezer are probably the three rock bands that have kind of orbited around relevancy for 3+ decades, which a lot of bands can't claim anymore. No. So,
I mean, a lot of those bands are still around, like, you know, your Everclears, your Gin Blossoms, whomever they are, but like, they're on the state fair circuit. They're playing rib burn-offs, right? They're playing like whatever weird bike week thing that's in your hometown. Like, they're not bands that have relevancy. They still have fans and they can still sell t-shirts, but they don't have relevancy, right? But like, yeah, you're right. Foo Fighters, I missed Foo Fighters. But yeah, Foo Fighters, Green Day, and Weezer are the only like active 90s acts that young people like. No young kid gives a shit about the Smashing Pumpkins or gives a shit about Beck or gives a shit. And these are all like great bands. So,
Right.
But they don't care about Jane's Addiction or even to a lesser extent, Rage Against the Machine. That band's kind of like not, I think the reunion tour being postponed a couple of years has really fucked that band over. But if you're looking at the '90s, like the Trinity is going to be, you know, Weezer, Green Day, and then Nirvana / Foo Fighters. And that's what kids still buy t-shirts of and still listen to.
I think part of it, thinking of those three bands together, is that they're more of a back to basics approach, I think, to rock and roll, which I think a lot their sound and what they're talking about, but also like their songs are relatively short for the most part, like 3 minute songs, maybe four at the most, but also they're very playful. These bands, like they have a lot of their music videos that are very colorful or zany or over the top, but I don't know. There's just something about those bands. I just think there's something there is why I think that they have that everlasting appeal. Let's talk about the first two albums, Self-Titled, which is the Blue Album, and Pinkerton. Those albums are regarded as classics nowadays. And really, Blue Album always kind of was. Like, it was an instant classic, I think, in many ways. Why do you think those albums are so, I guess, popular? Because I feel that people always go back to those two albums, especially. Mm-hmm. But any thoughts on that?
Boy, there's not a bad song on them. You have the what's incredible about that period of Weezer, if you include the B-sides from those respective records, you're at about 26 or 27 songs, if memory serves me correctly. And literally, none of those songs are below like an A minus. Like they're all so good. And it's like, well, maybe it's because they're all in E flat tuning, or maybe it's because they all have bridges, which a lot of songs that Rivers wrote after those first two records didn't have bridges in them. Maybe because they have these crazy guitar solos. Maybe because Rivers gets really deep lyrically on both records, whether he's talking about his stepfather on Saying It So, or talking about all the women he wishes he could have sex with on Tired of Sex, right? Maybe it's because he was writing these quirky songs about people in his real people in his life, like Jamie and Suzanne and Michael and Carly, three amazing B-sides from the Blue Album. Maybe it's because he was willing to be super open and forthright about his lusting for people on things like Across the Sea, which is, in my opinion, Weezer's absolute top tier best song. There's maybe it's Matt Sharp's falsettos. Like there's so many things on those two records that are unique to Weezer in that time period that you say like, well, of course they're classic. Cause like nothing else sounds like it. And even though so many bands have tried to rip off those sounds and that style, and Weezer themselves is ripping off other bands, right? Like it's how it works. That's a circle of life, right? It's just that window is just incredible to have a songwriter at their absolute creative peak and also their commercial peak. Like everyone's paying attention to you. And also you're writing the best songs of your life at that point, right? He had written a couple hundred songs before the Blue Album and he finally figured out how to do it, right?
And also they had success right off the bat too. So I think that's what's interesting about Weezer as opposed to say Green Day, because Green Day did have an EP or like
they had two whole records before Dookie. Yeah.
Right. And I think that's what's so fascinating about Weezer is that they pretty much almost became stars instantly, like at least on the alternative scene, it seemed like
within the first 6 months. Yeah. They were definitely like they slugged it out as the opening act for Live for a little bit. They were opening for the Teenage Fan Club, maybe. So they did their share of like shitty van tours where like people were like, who's this band? Right. But it didn't take long for everyone to say this is the band. Like they had it. You know, they absolutely had it.
And how much do you think MTV played a role too in their popularity, especially like with like
massive.
The Buddy
Holly? Massive. You know, any band from the 90s that is successful is because of MTV, right? MTV took risks that radio never did, especially in that window of like 92 to like 97, kind of before the boy bandification of MTV took over and the popification. You had that like 5 year window where major labels in the post-Nirvana signing rush, we're just signing anything. Like, well, it sounds kind of cool. Maybe some kids will buy it, right? And so you had all these bands that are destroying so much shit at a wall to see what would stick. And there was just it was an incredibly fertile time for what we now call alternative rock, because it was just people who were sick of blues-based rock and roll, like your Led Zeppelin and your Who and your Cream and all that kind of shit that their parents listened to. And they were sick of hair metal that all their older sisters listened to because it was just garbage. So they wanted something new, right? They wanted something that could be theirs. And Nirvana started that and it kept on going. So yeah, but for sure, being able to see all these bands on a platform as big as MTV that was in everyone's household in the 90s. And there were so many people in their 20s. I guess you call them, at that point it was Gen X, right? So I'm a millennial, but the Gen Xers are creating all this content for the millennials, right? And there's always one guy in that circle of people in that band who is a videographer, who's making these crazy videos. There's always this one guy who's putting themselves out there to be weird and wacky on like the MTV clip shows when they have them on for like 120 minutes or Headbangers Ball or whatever it is, right? So for sure, MTV made Weezer. MTV and Windows 95. That's what made Weezer, right? Because for those who don't know, the Buddy Holly music video was included without the band's permission or the label's permission, by the way, on the CD-ROM for Windows 95. And there was a brief moment where they're like, wait, what the fuck? We didn't get paid for this. And you realize, oh, wait, this went to literally millions of people. It's fine. Good. You know what I mean? So that was like the precursor to file sharing right there. So
that's very true. And also exposure is usually, even if you don't get paid, it's still good because then people will buy more records down the road, yeah, and sell absolutely more tickets. I think it's impossible to measure Weezer's popularity due to MTV. And I think it's almost immeasurable. But I think also they came at the right moment in time, like you were saying. Like they pretty much at that time when music videos, I think, did matter, because they really don't anymore unless it's like a Beyonce or like someone at like that level. And now it's all like on YouTube. But at that moment in time, you could watch Buddy Holly or See It Ain't So or those music videos on loop. And plus the
thing with those three videos for that first record is that they're all different. The first, yeah, you know, Undone is this kind of weird, surrealistic thing with the blue background. It's played in like hyper slow motion or whatever. So everything looks bizarre. The dogs are running around. It's so weird and like funny, but also like the song's so good. Right.
Yeah.
And then the Buddy Holly video is this incredible masterclass by Spike Jonze and how to make a music video something totally different and new, right? And he just ran with that after that, right? And everyone knows that video. And then you have Say It Ain't So, which came out like a year later, because they worked Buddy Holly for a long time. Okay. And the Say It Ain't So music video is so simple. It was shot in their practice space, in their garage, in the house they practiced in. And it's so like just bare bones. And it's the most powerful. Like that 3.5 minute video is so powerful. It shows this band just kicking ass with no bells and whistles, you know? And so that, and then following that up with, in my opinion, easily one of the greatest late night TV performances of any band ever, when they played Say It Ain't So on Letterman, which if you haven't watched that, go on YouTube and look it up. It is one of the most cathartic things I've ever seen in my life. At this point, Rivers was in the middle of having his leg extended. I don't know if you know this whole story about this.
Yes.
Yeah. So Rivers had a leg that was shorter than the other, and he spent the summer of 95 having it corrected by having like bolts put into his leg. And he had to like wear this gigantic cage over his leg and turn these screws every day, like 1/8 of an inch or whatever, to extend his leg. It was incredibly painful. He was probably high on painkillers almost every day that summer, and also could barely walk. So when you watch the video of them playing Say It Ain't So, he is stock still wearing these gigantic baggy pants to cover up this cage around his leg and just rocking back and forth, playing this incredibly, immensely personal song. And then Matt Sharp is just flying through the air behind him. It is incredible. It's burned into my brain. I watch it far too often than I probably should. So anyway, so yeah, that band, even though they were never visually interesting as people, they weren't like wearing crazy hats or crazy makeup or whatever, the visual element of Weezer is what sold that band to so many people, because it made you say, oh, they look like me, they act like me, they're playing hacky sack with their friends, they're like, it just, he's wearing a Star Wars t-shirt, like, I get this band, you know?
Yeah, that relatability, I think, really helps them so much. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've been popular even to this day. Like they could easily sell at any arena or even stadium at this point. They probably could if they really want to, depending on who else is on the bill.
Yeah. I wouldn't say stadium. I mean, when they just did that tour with Green Day, they were still the first of the three big bands, right? Fall Out Boy is bigger than Weezer right now in terms of ticket sales.
True.
Weezer's still big. And Weezer will do a summer amphitheater tour and draw 15,000 people a night, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because they have that many hits, and people just want to go pay $20 to sit on the lawn and get drunk and sing along. So that's fine.
That actually sounds like a good night, honestly.
It is.
Let's talk about Matt Sharp's exit from the band, yes. because I think this is really important to their story, because after the Blue Album, he went to Harvard. I think that's also important to keep in mind, and his kind of loneliness and his kind of, he didn't know what to do, like a crossroads moment is his, in his career as a musician, led to Pinkerton. And then the band was kind of in turmoil in a way, and then Matt Sharp ended up leaving. So let's just talk briefly about his exit from the band, because I think a lot of fans with Weezer have like a pre-Sharp and a post-Sharp. Yeah. Like it's like either you like just those two albums or you love them altogether, but there's a lot of divide. So I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about
it. Sure. So the biggest thing that no one can ever agree on is, did Matt Sharp leave Weezer or was Matt Sharp kicked out of Weezer? And right. I've asked this to Matt Sharp on the record before, and even he's not quite sure. Basically, to give some context, as the Blue Album was blowing up, Matt Sharp forms his own or starts his own band called The Rentals, including Pat from Weezer, and writes songs that kind of sound like Weezer, and then gets a record deal with Maverick Records, Madonna's record label, right? And so the Return of the Rentals, their first album, which has it's an amazing record, has songs like Friends of P and Waiting on It, great songs. That came out like a year after the Blue Album came out. So like the things were happening so fast for Weezer at this point. Like he's writing these songs on tour. He's recording them with Pat on the tour bus. He gets a record deal. He puts out this record and it's kind of like a minor hit. Like Friends of P goes into rotation on MTV. He's getting some attention. And Weezer is about to take a break to let Rivers go back to Harvard, right? And so this is in August of 95. They do they do Letterman. And then Rivers goes off to Harvard to start his freshman semester. And Matt Sharp and Spike Jonze and Pat Wilson go to the MTV VMAs, where they win a bunch of awards for Buddy Holly. And they go on stage and they act like a bunch of fools. That's what you did, right? And so Matt's trying to like get the Rentals off the ground. He's like kind of doing this whole kind of weird like proto-communist thing, which kind of like the whole kind of weird vibe of that record. And Rivers is off being in pain, both physically and mentally at college, right? So while the band's away and Rivers is starting to write the songs for Pinkerton, Matt's kind of becoming this minor rock star. You know, he's hanging out with Damon from Blur and he's getting this attention and that kind of stuff, right? And so then when they regather together in early 96 to start working on what would become Pinkerton, originally it was going to be this rock opera called Songs from the Black Hole, which was going to be this whole kind of weird sci-fi thing, and all the band members are going to play characters, the whole thing. It's honestly better off it never came out. It would have killed their career, even though there's some cool songs on it. It's all kind of come out later in the years past. So it eventually turns into Pinkerton. Some of the songs on Pinkerton would have been on the Black Hole, right? So Pinkerton's coming together. Matt Sharp is involved with the process, but then they go out on tour, and they go out with, they do headlining shows first, and the shows are selling out, but the record's not selling. So the band is getting really depressed because what the hell? We were huge. We sold 3 million records. We have these massive videos. What's going on? You know, why are we getting this attention? Why isn't people buying the record, right? But if you go to the shows, they're still selling out. So the band starts to kind of bottom out. And then at the end of 96, they do an Australian tour, which Alternative Press actually had a writer on to do a cover story. And it's this cover story that almost broke up the band because he was with them at their absolute bottoming out in Australia, where they just fucking hated each other. And basically, he gets Pat and Matt, the writer, gets Pat and Matt in a hotel room, gets them drunk, and they just endlessly shit talk Rivers for hours about how they hate him, blah, 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 whatever. And of course, it all goes to print because that's a juicy story, right? Mm-hmm. So a few months after that, when, you know, people don't realize that magazines are longly publications, it takes a few months for something to kind of make it to print. By the time it came out, the band had kind of reconciled with each other and they were cool again. And then the story comes out. It's like, wait, you said this about me? What the hell, right? That leads into the summer of 97. As kind of a last gasp for Weezer's relevancy, they get put as the support slot for No Doubt's big, gigantic summer tour in amphitheaters when they had Tragic Kingdom out, right? And they were going to be the support band for this, the main support band for this tour. As they're getting ready to do it, they are trying to push another single to radio called Pink Triangle. And Matt was currently in, I think, London or Barcelona or somewhere working on his second Rentals album. All right. And he gets a phone call saying, like, you have to be back to re-record your bass part for this radio version of this song. He's like, I can't. He's like, you have to. If you don't come back, you're out of the band. Well, I can't come back. I'm doing this thing. And that was pretty much the end of it, right? They did this tour, and then all of a sudden, Matt was just no longer in Weezer. And no one really knew, like, did Matt quit? Did Rivers kick Matt out? Was it, you can't fire me, I quit? Like, it's still up in the air, and the memories of everyone is fuzzy, right? They tried to reconcile shortly thereafter when, as Weezer took a hiatus, Rivers started a solo side project called Homie, which recorded one song for a soundtrack to a movie called Meet the Deedles, which, don't worry, you haven't seen. Nobody else has either. Starring Paul Walker, a pre-famed Paul Walker. And it's a great song called American Girls. And Rivers called up Matt Sharp to come out to Boston, where they recorded the song, to like kind of co-produce it and like do some vocals on it. And they did that. And that was the last time they worked together for, gosh, 10, 12 years, something like that. In the meantime, Matt sued Rivers over songwriting royalties, all this kind of stuff. And the band went away, then they came back, and everyone was like, well, these songs, you know, the Green Album and Maladroit and everything else since then, everyone's like, well, this doesn't sound like the first two records. It's probably because of Matt Sharp, you know? Yep. And maybe it is. Maybe Matt was Rivers' muse. Maybe Matt was the guy, even though Rivers wrote everything and this is his band, you know, there's nothing to be said for band chemistry. And if you're pulling back your bus curtain at 2 a.m. when you're driving to Madrid or whatever, saying, hey, Matt, what do you think about this cool lyric? And he's like, yeah, that's really good. Or no, let me try something else. That could have helped shape things, right? So it's, you'll never really know how much impact Matt had on those two records. Everyone thinks he had a lot of impact. He'll tell you he did, which you should believe your own hype, right? They're still Rivers' songs. And if you hear the demos, they sound like the same thing. But also, Matt just had that spark. He was the rock star in that band.
Yeah.
You know? And they've never really been the same since, even though they've made so many incredible songs, honestly. So many great albums. I mean, like albums that I would put up there against Pinkerton and Blue, not involving Matt Sharp, right? But you just wonder if Matt would have stayed in the band, what would have happened? Who knows? Maybe they would have broken up. You know what I mean? They didn't get along.
It's one of the great mysteries of modern rock is like, I'll be serious, because like they had all this momentum for the first two albums. He leaves. And I think what's really important to think about with their discography for a sec is they only released two albums in the 90s. And they're kind of like a distinctly 90s band in a way, in the minds of many. Not really, but they kind of are, because that's where they got their foot in. But they also released, I think, 13 or 14 albums in the...
And more on the way, trust me.
Yeah, it's just insane how prolific they are. But it wasn't in their prime. It was more later on. I mean, even though they still are relevant and whatnot, if they kept that up with the 90s, I mean, they would have probably been a first ballot band without a doubt.
Maybe. It's one of those things where people say, oh, do you have any regrets? Right. You can't, because your life is what it is and the choices you make lead to where you are today. Right. Mm-hmm. And Rivers had to kind of go through this thing, this mental break for 2 years and try to solve the mystery of writing the perfect song, which he, you know, would chart out every single Green Day song, every single Oasis song, and every single Beatles song. He had this gigantic like book binder of just every single song those three bands wrote, figuring out, these are the best songs of all time. How do I write these? Right. And that's what he did. He broke it down. So it's like, he had to go on that journey, and they've all had to go on their journeys. Right. So it's like, if Matt was in the band, they probably would have made a third record, then they would have broken up and no one would be talking about it. You know what I mean? And so it's like, right. Who knows?
I think it helped them in the long run, though, because in terms of productivity, kind of like, you're right. Like, it is kind of like their journey of how they became who they are. So it took a little bit longer to put out records at first. But once things happened for them, like with Matt Sharp leaving, they've been pretty consistent. I mean, like 13 or 14 studio albums. It doesn't even include EPs or singles. Yeah. Like, I think that's just insane for a major rock band like Weezer.
There are three more coming out this year.
I know. That's why I was thinking to myself, I had to look, and they had like an EP that came out recently. I'm just like, they're Mad Men. They just keep pushing out more and more stuff. We've been talking a lot about their 90s. Anything that stands out in their 21st century period? Any changes in style or anything that maybe they did differently in terms of like approaching music to making music? Anything that you think stands out?
Sure. Well, first off, I do want to give a plug to, unfortunately, this podcast is currently dormant, but there was a great podcast that aired for a couple of years called Post Pinkerton, where the host just picked a song by Weezer every week that was Post Pinkerton, right? That means it's something that came out past 97, right? And just break it down and go through the whole thing. It's an excellent listen. I recommend everyone, once they're done with this episode and every other episode that you've ever made, then go back and find Post Pinkerton. It's a great podcast. But that's the thing, is like the journey that Weezer's gone on over the past 20 years has been like, let's even go through this. Green Album, faceless power pop, the most boring songs of all time that are still somehow catchy, the most boring guitar solos, the most meaningless lyrics, but it's still good, right? 25-minute album, it's insane. All right. Maladroit, their big dumb rock record. I love it. Riffs for days, again, stupid lyrics, they rush through it, right? Make Believe, all right? A bad record, but one that had a couple really good songs on it because Rivers was actually like being nice again to people. Like he'd been an asshole for so long. And that record was basically his gigantic apology note to his band members, to his former partners, to everybody, right? And that's the album that gives you Perfect Situation in Beverly Hills. Beverly Hills, terrible song. Everyone loves it. Perfect Situation, amazing song, top tier Rivers of all time. Incredible song, right? They go away again. The Red Album comes out in 2008. A really fucking weird record with a lot of really cool songs on it that then gets totally ruined on the second half when Rivers decides he wants to be collaborative for the first time in his career and let all the other members of the band have their own song on the B side of the record, right? And those songs just kill the record's momentum. But the first half of that record, great stuff. That's where Pork and Beans and Troublemaker come from, right? The very next year, you get Ratitude, a dog shit record featuring a dog on the cover. It's terrible. And this is the start of like the worst period of Weezer. And the worst problem with Rivers at this point is that he then started turning to co-writers. And ever since 2009, he's been using co-writers almost exclusively on everything he's been putting out since then, which is endlessly frustrating to longtime fans who know that he still has these songs in him. And we know that because once in a while on these later era records, he'll have songs that are just written by him that are phenomenal. He'll even go back and bring out old songs from the 90s that never got released and put them on new albums. For example, Van Weezer, which came out last year, has a song on it called Sheila Can Do It, which he wrote in 1997. Right. Yeah. So like they're all still there. Right. So, okay. So Ratitude, dog shit record, absolutely terrible. Okay. Then you have the next year, 2010, Hurley, a super underrated record featuring Hurley from Lost on the cover that was paid for by Hurley, the clothing company. Oh my God. It became hard to be a Weezer fan at this point. It really, really, really,
it
did.
Really though, was.
Yeah. Even though there's good songs on that record, there's also some atrocious songs in that record. And then on top of that, you have the same period where they're putting out Hurley. They also reissue Pinkerton. It finally gets that kind of critical reevaluation and they start playing Blue Album Pinkerton on tour in two night stands all across the country. That simultaneously was the worst time to be a Weezer fan and the best time to be a Weezer fan. Right. And the same time as all that happens, you have this deluxe edition of Pinkerton. They put out a B-sides compilation called Death to False Metal, which has some really shitty songs on it, but also some really cool songs on it, right? And that was the first time we got to see what was in the vault. I'm like, what is he holding on to, right? What does Rivers have in his back pocket? And some of it was pretty good. Then they go away for four more years. And then you get, in my opinion, top tier, two very top tier Weezer albums, Everything Will Be All Right in the End, which might be their best start to finish album, legitimately. And then you get the White Album, which is just so good. Power pop hit after power pop hit. That album got them a Grammy nomination, right? Yeah. And well-deservedly, right? So then let's see, we're at 2015. What comes next? Pacific Daydream, dog shit, horrible album. The Black Album, underrated, but still not very good. Then they go away again. The Teal Album. I hate the Teal Album. It kills me.
That Teal Album, they have no scrubs and so they have that, like I some of these one, songs like that are, you have to listen because like when you see the songs they're covering,
yeah,
you're like, sweet dreams. I mean, these are like, they do a good job with some of them, but you do a double take where you're like, really?
I should briefly point out that I am responsible for Toto, Weezer covering Toto's Africa. I've told the story before. I'll tell it again really quickly. As I mentioned, I work at School of Rock. At the time of whatever that was, 2017, I was directing a Weezer show. And I had a student in my show named Mary who liked Weezer a lot. And they decided they wanted to make a Twitter account that would bug Rivers Cuomo every day. And they said, if I did that, would you retweet it? I said, sure, you know, whatever. I got a couple thousand followers, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So they made at Weezer Africa, and they made it because Pat Wilson tweeted about their neighbor listening to Africa by Toto. And so they made this account and they started tweeting to the band and the members of the band every day. I was its first follower. I retweeted it. And then a bunch of my journalist friends jumped on it. It became a big story, which led to the band covering Africa, which is the bane of my existence. It's now their biggest song of the past 20 years. I hate it, but also I love it. It's that's Weezer, man. So, and then we move on. There's OK Human, which is an incredible record. Van Weezer, which also sucks, but is also great. The new EP, Season Spring, is cool. There's so much. And then in between all of that, Rivers decides during the pandemic to release thousands of demos, literally thousands of demos. You could never listen to all of them if you wanted to. It's insane. So like the past 20 years, Weezer fans were just begging for these nuggets of the stuff that we never get to hear. Please, Rivers, just give us one song here, one song there, right? And it was just a drip here, drip there. And then all of a sudden, the whole damn faucet broke. And we were inundated with literally thousands of songs that he just said, figure out what's good and what's not good. It's like the Prince approach, right? That's how Prince approaches music, was I'll make it, you tell me if it's good or not, right?
Yeah, that is so exactly what it is.
Yeah, so the journey of Weezer is really the journey of Rivers, which is not to diminish anyone else in that band, but it's his beast, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have these rock albums, you have these pop albums, you have these co-writing songs, you have them getting back to basics. You have them literally apologizing to fans via song on Back to the Shack, saying, maybe, you know, I'm sorry, guys, I didn't realize I needed you so much. You know, I'm going to play the guitar and pedal to the drums, because he literally had Pat Wilson playing guitar on tour. They had a fill-in drummer, right? So like, he's literally writing songs about apologizing to their fan base for co-writing and trying to make pop songs. And then he goes back and makes pop songs. It doesn't make any sense. Nothing makes any sense in Weezer's world. That's what's great. It's, you never know what weird ass thing they're going to do next. That's why it's so great, man.
I love the roller coaster. Like, kind of like it just go ups and down. And even because I passively listened to Weezer my whole life. So like, I know their work pretty well. You're right. It kind of does have this, it goes up, it goes down. But I like that about them in a way, because it feels like it makes me want to listen to their music even more. So that's just, I actually admire that more about them, that they're just like, sure, we'll just do this or that. And it might be shit.
That's what's so appealing, is that I think that's why they keep finding new fans, because it's easy to be a casual fan of Weezer because they have 15 songs that you've heard every day on the radio for the past 20 years, right? So like, it's easy to be like, oh yeah, I know Weezer, I know Beverly Hills, I know Island of the Sun, whatever it is, right? But then if you want to get any deeper, there's just this universe that can suck you in, right? And that's what makes them so unique, because I don't see that with like, say, Pearl Jam or any, what's another, you know, a 90s band, Jane's Addiction or whatever. Like, these bands don't have that quirk to them where it's like, they don't have the pop success that Weezer has and has sustained for decades. And they don't have the insanely idiosyncratic lead singer who has every neurosis under the book and will do the weirdest shit possible. You know what I mean? So like, it has that, it's just so many layers and levels to what Weezer is. That's why I love them.
Yeah, me too. Just an overall great band too, that just, I don't know, there's just something that draws me back every time to want to listen to their music and their new music. And I can't say that for many current bands that have at least that longevity or anywhere near that longevity as a Weezer. We talked about some of the bands that influenced Weezer. Who do you think are some of the bands that Weezer influenced?
Every pop rock band of the past 20 years.
I literally wrote that in my notes. I said virtually every alternative lean-in rock and pop act, pretty much.
Yes. I mean, we never would have had the third wave of emo were it not for Weezer. So you're talking things like Dashboard Confessional and the Get Up Kids and Jimmy Eat World.
Right.
You never, and even continuing bands like Taking Back Sunday and Bayside, who love Weezer and cover their songs every night and stuff like that, right? Any like bigger alt-rock band like Panic at the Disco, Fall Out Boy, the All-American Rejects, all that whole wave of like emo scene, Warped Tour-centric pop rock, all that stuff. They all worship Weezer. Bands like Not a Surf, they love Weezer. Like Michael Cera, the actor, loves Weezer. Like they're just ubiquitous, right? So like, there's so many musicians that have like made have tried to just be Weezer and they can't, right? It's not a guitar tone, right? It's not a quirky thing. Like you have these bands like Nerf Herder or Ozma or whomever who just try to be like, oh yeah, we're kind of crunchy geek rock, right? Blah, blah, blah. But like, it's just not the same, man. You can't be a one of a kind band, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they've influenced, as I've said for a long time, that Cheap Trick influenced every band that played rock and roll from their inception till like 1991. And then Nirvana influenced every good band for 2 years and every bad band for 30 years. And then Weezer has influenced every like pop rock band in the interceding time. Right. And there's no getting around it.
I absolutely agree. I feel like the now that you said the Nirvana, I feel like it's Led Zeppelin too. Like that Led Zeppelin effect. Sure. Led Zeppelin's awesome. And they're one of the greatest bands ever, but they also inspired a lot of shitty bands, just like sure. Nirvana in many ways. But hey, you can't blame the guys of Nirvana or Zeppelin, because that's the music that people were influenced by. But yeah, I feel like Weezer is just one of those ubiquitous bands, like you said, that just, it's such a turning point where you could see it before and after with them, just like Green Day. And I just feel like those two bands, but especially Weezer, you could see that kind of influence on all the bands that you mentioned, because you name dropped like every band that I had without even batting an eye. So I think that that's incredible. Let's move on to the probably the funnest part of this entire interview, the playlist section. So if you were to make a playlist for essential Weezer songs that like you think five or six songs you think everyone has to listen to by Weezer, it could be what you think are the hits, or you could think any way you want to frame it.
Okay, here's what I'll do, because I think that anyone listening to this has probably heard all the big hits, right? And they know Weezer as like an entity, but they might not have picked up a record, a more recent record, right? So let's look at like the past, let's say 10 years. So let's, or 10 to 15 years, right? So the songs from like kind of their post comeback, like multiple times. So we're talking like the Red Album onward. Let's even say, you know what? I'll start with Ratitude. Ratitude, dog shit album, has a couple great songs on it. Number one, I really like the song Put Me Back Together, which he co-wrote with two members of the All-American Rejects, ironically. It's a great little power pop song, went unnoticed as most of these songs did. The very next year, he did a song called Hang On. Weezer did a song called Hang on Hurley. An amazing, just three chords, super simple, melancholy rock song. It should have been a hit, just didn't get the attention it needed, right? What are you gonna do? There's so much good stuff on Everything Will Be All Right in the End and the White Album. That's really hard to narrow those down. I would say for the White Album, listen to LA Girls, an absolutely incredible song. I don't even know how they wrote that song. It's wild to me. And then looking at Everything Will Be All Right in the End, my God, that record is such a really cool story that it's hard to break out any part in that. Da Vinci. Da Vinci should have been a hit too. I don't know how you write Da Vinci and it doesn't become a hit on the radio. That's the fault of a radio programmer. What do I have left? Two more? Do I get two more slots?
You get two more.
Oh shit. Honestly, OK Human, their album that came out in the pandemic last February, was my favorite album of last year. In some ways, a weird spiritual successor to Pinkerton, not sonically, but because it's Rivers wrote Pinkerton when he was, 25 and dissatisfied with life, right? And didn't know what he wanted and what was going to happen to him and just what he's supposed to be, right? And then he writes OK Human when he's, 45 or 50 and dissatisfied with life. And I'm married now. I have kids. Am I still a rock star? What is this? What is my life? I'm so bored, right? And there's so many cool songs on that record. I'm going to have to go with Bird with a Broken Wing. Phenomenal song. And then honestly, I really enjoy the new EP, Seasons, Spring. I really like, there's a song on that record called Angels on Vacation, which feels like kind of vintagey Weezer, but still feels like new Weezer in a way that makes me say, yeah, they know what they're doing. If Rivers wanted to, he could give you a Blue Album Part 2 tomorrow if he wanted to.
Oh, yeah.
But he doesn't want to. He wants to follow his muse, you know what I mean? And his muse goes to a lot of weird places.
Yeah, those are all some excellent choices. I'm glad you didn't go with the classics, because even the songs I wrote down, these are almost canonical songs of the 90s and 2000s. So I appreciate that you took a unique approach to answering that.
You can ask me tomorrow, I can give you six different songs. I mean, there's, and I could do unreleased songs, and there's so many. It's insane. So.
Oh, it's beyond insane. Because even when I didn't really think of it at first, but then when I started writing it down, I'm like, oh, wow, this is like 15 songs without even batting an eye. I'm going to just run down a few awards and honors that Weezer has won or received over the years. Feel free to mention any that I have missed. They won one Grammy for Best Music Video for Porks and Beans. They had full out of five total nominations. They won five MTV Video Music Awards, four of which were for Buddy Holly and one for Pork and Beans. The Rolling Stone list of the 500 greatest albums, the Blue Album was on the first one at 299, and the most recent update in 2020, it went up to 294. On the Rolling Stone 500 greatest songs, Buddy Holly's on all the iterations of the list, I believe. 2004, 497, at 2010, 499, and in 2020, 484, I believe,
for that one. Hold on by a thread.
Hold on up by a thread. Like one critic has voted for them at like number one.
Yeah, every time.
And then it's like, another one's like at like 50. And I'm like, okay, you just made the list. Blue Album's number 35 on Rolling Stone's list of the best debut albums. And I thought this was really interesting when they did in 2014, the 20th anniversary of the 1994 albums, the 40 best of that year. They were at number three. The only two that were ahead of them are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that's the
By Green Day, probably.
Yeah, that's number one. Yeah. And then Downward Spiral by Nightshale's number Nails. Two.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So that's pretty great. And then I think Jeff Buckley and Nirvana's MTV Unplugged album is in the top five. So that's a pretty awesome top five.
Honestly, a bulletproof top five. I own all those records downstairs in my record shelf for sure. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the strongest years of music too, because it's just incredible the amount of talent across all genres, not even just rock, that were just incredible. Now, this is the one that I thought was the most interesting, is that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has their 500 songs, or now it's 600 songs that shaped rock and roll list. And Undone is one of the 600 or so songs that the people at the museum selected, which I think is really a good indicator for their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame prospects, which is the next question I'm going to ask you.
Sure.
So Weezer was first eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2020. They have not been nominated yet. How would you present your case that Weezer should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I kind of wrote this a little bit in my article that you referenced earlier, which, by the way, I should plug. It's colorsofinsomnia.substack.com. It's a free online newsletter. Yep. So go subscribe to that. And what I said was, the Rock Hall is notoriously late to everything. Still to this day. And they're trying to slowly creep into the 90s, but their voters are still stuck in the 70s and now 80s after this year. And when I look at the ballot this year, I'm like, yeah, Beck's cool and all, but like, why would you nominate Beck? Like, he has no chance. So it's like, are you nominating Beck to be like your token 90s band, knowing that he won't get in? Because like, it was clear from the nominees who was getting in this year from day one. Like, obviously it's Dolly, obviously it's Eminem, et cetera, right? So I think, okay, are they saving Weezer for a year they know they're going to get in? Because Weezer to me seems like a shoe-in, because I don't know of any other band from that era, except for the Foo Fighters and Green Day, who are in, who managed to remain relevant to youth every couple of years, you know? Right. Even more so, honestly, even though Foo Fighters and Green Day are bigger bands than Weezer and have won more awards, I mean, list up all of Weezer's accomplishments, it's not a lot. Right. They don't have like Grammys on Grammys. They don't have they're only Grammys for music video. Right. Like even though there's this huge band, they're still weirdly underrated in terms of being honored. And I think that works against them. Right. So it's like, this is what you need to do. Like, put Weezer in. There's no band from that era that is still not just relevant, but like still capturing new fans every single time they put out new music, you know? Like, the Chili Peppers are not relevant anymore, right? They are not. They are coasting off of, you know, they're coasting. I think that band is dog shit. That's another thing. They start. Like, they've been coasting forever, right? But, like, they're held in this high regard, you know? Mm-hmm. Green Day, I love Green Day, but their last few records have been a little bit sus, right? Even though I still buy them, because I owe Green Day my life, and if it wasn't for Dookie, I wouldn't be here, right? And then you look at Foo Fighters. Also, I love Foo Fighters. Haven't had a good record since Wasting Light. You know, that's the struggle with that one, right? Although I did think the most recent one was pretty good, better than the last two for sure. So it's like Weezer is still pushing the boundaries of what a rock band can do, They're still active. They're still mainstream. They still have fans everywhere. They are the best charting alternative band on the radio of all time, I think, in terms of like number one singles. I think right behind them is the Chili Peppers. And then I think Muse, who also, if the Rock Hall were smart, would fucking nominate Muse next year. Because talk about another band that can fill arenas that's still relevant, right? So whatever reason the Rock Hall is afraid of I think kind of like casting all this stuff out there now, because they're trying so hard to branch out what rock and roll is instead of just pivoting to alt rock. Because I feel like if you pivot to alt rock, you can't branch out anymore. Because then that leads us to the death of rock and roll, right? Because once you get through the alt rock run of the 90s, who are you going to induct from the 2000s? Arcade Fire, The Strokes, The White Stripes. Like it's a real quick downward slide where there's no more like traditional rock in quotation marks bands left. So they have to diversify and bring in whatever mainstream pop name they forgot about 20 years, 30 years ago, whatever. That's your Lionel Richie, your Carly Simon, whoever it is. So it's like, I think they're just afraid of guitars right now. I really think they're afraid of guitars.
I think it's part of it is that the voters have never been fans of alternative rock or anything alternative lean in, unless they're a no-brainer FYE inductee like a Pearl Jam or
Green Day, or a Nirvana. Even Radiohead didn't get in the first year, right? Fucking Radiohead.
I know Radiohead, like the biggest band worldwide. Yeah. Like our generation's like Pink Floyd. The best way to put it. They had to wait a year. But I think the problem is with these voters is that anything that's a little too alternative, it's like scares them away. That's why, like, when I looked at this ballot, I thought Rage had better chances years prior. I don't know why. Like this year, I was like, they're not gonna get in. Like when you have all these like titans of popular music on the ballot, and Beck, who I love Beck too, but again, Beck was never really a mainstream commodity. I mean, he is, you know, someone who could easily be on Saturday Night Live at any given year. He could be on any given award show, he could win Album of the Year, but there's something about Beck that for a lot of people, I disagree with this, is that he's like a one-trick pony and where he's kind of like just this weird guy, the same loser. Part of what I thought was the problem with this year's induction class, and I'm probably going to write a blog about this, is that the 90s are missing. There's like this void, right? Because it's so heavy on the 80s. And Eminem isn't really a 90s artist. He's a 2000s artist He got his start in the 90s, but he's not really part of that canon. But in this year's class, there's zero inklings of the 90s, really. And even like the nomination committee, they only put up really two acts, and two acts that are probably hard sells, at least with the ballots that they're producing. Because you got to think, and I know this sounds silly, you have to almost think like an average Rock Hall voter is probably in their 60s, right?
Oh, if not older, yeah.
I would say 65. Anyone who has a card-carrying member of AARP, that's who. I'm being dead serious because Eminem and, well, not Eminem. That's not who I was thinking of. Like Carly Simon and Lionel Richie. And even the Eurythmics, because like Annie Lennox has done a lot of adult contemporary stuff. That would appeal more easily to like that voting group than Rage Against the Machine, who, by the way, I think Rage needs something to remind us why they matter. Like, they need a new album.
I really think that they would have gotten in had the reunion tour happened in 2020. I really do, because
100%.
I mean, that tour has been sold out for 2.5 years now. It's just been postponed and postponed. I've been holding tickets for 2.5 years. And I think it sucks for them, because whether or not, that's the thing too, is like, obviously Tom Morello cares, but do you think Zach De La Rocha cares about going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? I don't think so. And also, I can't imagine them playing that fucking thing. I can't imagine them playing, because it's so
anti them.
Yeah. It's like, it's the most blatantly capitalist thing. It's like selling $10,000 tables for benefactors on the floor. And like, it seems insane to me that they would do it. Now, do they belong in the institution? Absolutely. So it's like, it's so strange that they've been nominated 3 times and just haven't gotten anywhere. And like, four times. And like, they're so good. They have an unimpeachable catalog. 3 albums, all great. A covers album, equally as great. It's insane to me that they have. I thought they were going to coast right in, you know. But they've just been. I think the pandemic hurt them, and I think that like just not educating your voting body on why a band is being nominated. Because it's like, if listen, these ballots go out to everyone who's been in the Rock Hall, right? Do you fucking think that Keith Richards is filling out a ballot? No, right? There's no chance in hell at this point now that any of those people from like the earlier years are still filling out ballots for, in terms of performers. Mick Jagger looks at the ballot and says, I don't know these people. Who are these people, right? I mean, he's not going to go listen to them. He's not going to go put on a Devo record or put on a, you know, he'll vote for Carly Simon because he sang with her on You're So Vain, and that's it. And the ballot goes back, right? So like you have an uninterested upper class of classic rock dinosaurs who are still gasping for breath, who have zero interest in learning about music that came after them, right? Once hair metal happened, they're like, I'm out. I'm going to play my same 25 songs on tour for the next 50 years until I die. And outside of like your rare, like Elton John, for example, who does take a lot of interest in what's happening modern day, most of those people do not care. They do not know, they do not care. And no one's going to tell them otherwise, right? They don't view the Rock Hall as important because they're already in it. So why do they care? Right. And so you have this weird thing where you have this, the people who are supposed to be deciding are checked the fuck out. And then you have like the rest of the voters are not cohesive enough to get in the people who need to get in, and they get suckered in by big names. It's a popularity contest, right?
Oh, it's so I've always thought that the Rock Hall, essentially it's democracy in like in form, because usually it's a lot of the times that people like maybe are the most popular names or who sold the most records, they tend to get in, especially now that you're in this HBO era of the Rock Hall, where it's all about putting on a show. It's always about putting on a show, like throughout its history. But now it's like a hyper awareness to get that, which is why I think a band like Weezer could get in very soon. I think if, you know, I just don't know when Weezer is going to show up on a ballot. I don't know, because even like Beck this year not get it in, it, or Rage, it kind of makes me think, are we going to see a period now where 90s artists or artists who were like defined in some way by the 90s, are they going to be like how new wave and alternative rock in the 80s were at one point, like 10 years ago, where you couldn't get the Cure in or the Smiths or the Eurythmics off the bat. And there's going to create
like get the Smiths in, which is insane. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I know. It's bonkers. But I
mean, you haven't gotten the Pixies nominated. You haven't gotten the Violent Femmes nominated. You haven't got the Replacements got nominated once and didn't get come close to the top of the ballot. Like, I think what makes me wonder is like, would I rather have Weezer be nominated on a ballot where I'm like, they're not going to get in this ballot? Or would I rather like them go the Duran Duran route where they're not nominated for 10 years when they should be? And then everyone's like, what the hell? Like, put them in, right? Like, because Duran Duran deserved to be in. Absolutely. I fully support that. And Annie Zaleski, if you're listening, my former coworker, she is the biggest Duran Duran stan that I know. And they deserved it. And they scratched and clawed to get in there. Same with the Go-Go's. The Go-Go's deserved it too, right? Even though their catalog is wispy at best, the Go-Go's, but like as a cultural entity, they should be there, right? So it's like, well, would you rather wait until the tipping point is there where you have to acknowledge it so they just get right in? Or do you put up a band like a Devo or a band like an MC5 or New York Dolls over and over again? And every time they miss out on it, it's a diminishing return. Then is it more insulting to be nominated and not get in? Like if Weezer gets nominated and they don't get in, it's like, well, what the fuck? Like what, you know, what are we then, right? What's the point? And so I'm really torn on how I want to see that play out. Do I think they would go in if they were nominated? It's very dependent on how they construct the ballot, right?
That's how I always tell people, because some people always say like, oh, they would get in off the bat if it's not first year. And I'm always like, it always boils down to who else is on this ballot, because, you know,
they haven't even nominated No Doubt, which to me is a shoo-in. And that's Gwen Stefani, one of the most famous people in the world, right?
Oh, I think like they will get in off the bat. They will get in the Blondie way, where it's in the sense like they will just, as soon as they're on a ballot, just think of the Urban Azoff connection for a sec.
Yeah.
Like just to see industry, because I think that's what this
year. Stefani is an icon across multiple genres, multiple decades, right? They're issuing, but they've been eligible for 10 years, right?
I think
they're
like five.
Their first material came out in the 80s with a different singer. So like, if you're going to go by like the Rock Hall thing, like they had something, I think they had a 7-inch in like 88 or something like that. I have to go back and look again, but like either way, they've been nominated or they've been eligible for more than a couple of years, right?
Yeah. I think that the 90s, it's hard because the only ones that I'm super confident that I've always said are Outkast, Sheryl Crow, and then I always thought Beck, as soon as like Beck came on about, but that was proven otherwise. But I think
it's also before they decided to make the Rock Hall about like the celebrity Hall of Fame. And it's like, you know, with your Dolly Partons and your Lionel Richies and your, and it's like, they're just picking names that are going to get headlines, right? And Weezer won't get a headline if they get in. Weezer will get a headline if they don't make it, right? No one's going to publish a story like Beck snubbed by the Rock Hall, but Weezer will definitely get that story if they don't get in, right? People say Weezer didn't get in. What the hell, right? So it's like, it's, you wonder what the hell's happening in those boardrooms to decide what's going to go up and what's not going to go up. It seems impossible that they could be that clueless. So it's like, are they playing us for fools or are they just fools?
I think it's because they created a system where it almost makes it an institution of exclusivity, but now it's kind of like, now that people are, oh, why is this person and that person? And they're trying to fill in all these like gaps, and it creates such a backlog now to the point that you can't even get, you were saying the MC5, and we did an episode on the MC5. You can't get to a lot of these foundational artists of genres or styles because they're just not well known enough, or people aren't educated enough about these artists. But it's also really hard to stand out when a Dolly Parton's on the ballot, or like Duran Duran or anyone like that on this year's class. I think Weezer could get in their first year, but I think it always depends on who else is on the ballot with them. And I think the problem with the Rock Hall, with not putting them up, is that they fill the void of like the mainstream rock act. Even though they're alternative lean-in, they're still like a mainstream entity in the sense that they could, I think, get in their first year. But I think what's also hard about a band like Weezer is that a lot of the bands that influenced them, it took forever for them to get in, like Cheap Trick and Kiss. Mm-hmm. And even Van Halen had to wait a few years.
Mm-hmm. They're populist bands, yeah.
Yeah, some of these populist bands. But then a lot of bands that, like you said, the Pixies and bands like that, they're not in. So it's kind of hard to kind of know when the time will come. Yeah. But I feel like, what do you think that Weezer would appear on a ballot? Like, I mean, if you had to take a guess.
In my mind, as a fan, they should have been on the first year they were eligible, right?
Rivers had that infamous tweet, if you remember, that I think is long deleted, where I really wish I had a screenshot of it. He wrote this like crazy tweet, and like, it's Rivers, so it's like very stream of consciousness. And he was basically like, I think it was like sometime in 2018 or 2019, because they were eligible for the class of 2020. So the ballot would have been out fall 2019. And he said something to the extent of like, I can't wait to get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with Oasis in the class of 2020. And neither band has been nominated.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think Oasis should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's another, sorry. One good record, one great record, and a lot of really bad records.
I just want to see the wrestling match that is, you know, Liam and Noel, because, you know, that would make Dire Straits look like a community. I'm
talking about bands that shouldn't be in the Rock Hall. Dire Straits, who gives a shit? At least they're pivoting away from like these like C-level Steve Miller Band garbage stuff that never should have sent the Rock Hall in the first place. Todd Rundgren, I'm looking at you. They're moving at least away from that stuff and trying to have some semblance of like pop cultural relevancy. Whether it pertains to music relevancy is another story, right? I think that Weezer should be on a ballot. Here's what I'll tell you. Before the ballot got announced for this current class, right? Before they put the ballot out, I texted their manager the night before and said, hey, like, tomorrow's the big day. Do you think you're going to get a nomination? He goes, what are you talking about? I was like, the Rock Hall. He's like, oh, we're not even like thinking about it. Like, so, and in some ways, so like that shows you like, it's not, they're not working. They're not trying to work behind the scenes to get it. They're not thinking about it, because I think in one way going to the Rock Hall, yeah, it's validation, but it's also like dating yourself to some degree. And Weezer is incredibly effective at feeling young, right? Like, it almost creepily in a way. It's almost like Benjamin Button-y, like, how are you still, like, you're all approaching or over 50, and some of you are approaching 60, and it's like, how is this, how, right? Whereas like, you see the age in Foo Fighters, you see the years, right? You see that. Weezer still feels baby-faced in some bizarre way, right? So it's like, they're not lobbying for it on the back end. I would think, like, we'll see how this year plays out with the other EPs. If they can get a single from one of these EPs that hits, they have to. I mean, like, it's going to push them back into public consciousness. I think they'll get nominated next year. I think if they're not nominated in the next half decade, I'm going down to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum and walking in there and just saying that why. I'll just do a sit in. You can handcuff me to the flying hot dog car from Fish that's hanging in the museum. And I'll say, what's going on? Justice for Weezer. That's my hashtag. So
hashtag justice for Weezer. Please.
Yeah, you can PayPal me my bail money right now. It's fine. So go ahead. Well,
something that helps them though, Scott, is that on those fan kiosk votes that are in the museum, at one point Weezer was in the top 10. I forgot which year it was, but they're always
Every time I'm there. Every time I'm there, I cast a vote.
Yeah, they're one of those bands that like they're always gonna do well. I mean, there's some other acts that are ahead of them that I'm like, I do not want to see them in the Rock Hall. Like, I wouldn't say not to put someone in the Rock Hall. Like, if they got in, whatever. But I'm not like on the dying hill for Motley Crue. But that's like some of the.
Honestly, I would make the case for Motley Crue. I think they should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, I think they should chew it away. But like, they're also like not a priority for me. Like, I would. There's so many more.
My thought is, if you put Motley Crue in, then we're done with 80s hard rock, and that like, there's nothing else. Like, what? You know, like that's the last band from that window that should be it, because you haven't Guns N' Roses, you haven't Van Halen, you haven't Bon Jovi, which whatever. But like Motley Crue deserves to be it. And because then it's like you're never putting in Poison. You know what I mean? You put in Def Leppard, whatever. So it's like you put in Motley Crue, that's it. We can move on. It's one more bookend of the 80s. I'm all about like capping off the 80s, right? So like let's finally become relevant. Let's at least nominate the Pixies. The Pixies created alternative rock, right?
They influenced like, Nirvana. Like,
yeah, you literally wouldn't have. So it's like out of like, so I'm currently at School of Rock. I'm directing a show that's called Left of the Dial, 80s Alternative, right? And here are the bands I have in the show. Okay. And we can go through Rock Hall, you know, where they fall. REM, they're in. Worthy, right? All these bands are worthy, I think. The Cure, they're in, right? The Smiths, nominated, didn't get in. Violent Femmes, never nominated, should be. The Pixies, never nominated, should be. The Replacements, nominated once, haven't been in. The B-52s, never been nominated. That's a criminal act, right? Sushi and the Banshees. I don't know if they should go in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but you should toss them a nomination and see what happens. You know what I mean? Like, cool band.
Susie's awesome. I love them.
Cool band, right? Who am I forgetting in that show? That might be everything. Oh, and the Dead Milkmen, who I love, they're not a Rock Hall band. That's fine. I'm fine with the Dead Milkmen not being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Fine. But like, you haven't even like looked at the Pixies. You haven't even looked at it. It's insane to me how disrespectful the Rock Hall is to like college rock and beyond. Like, music made by smart people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Unless you're like the Talking Heads, that's where it stops. It's like, okay, we did CBGBs and then we're just ignoring punk rock. We're ignoring indie rock. I'm like, you guys, you haven't nominated Black Flag. You haven't nominated Fugazi. Whether Fugazi would even show up, of course they wouldn't. But like, if you are what you say you are, tell the story of rock and roll. Don't tell the story of pop culture. Tell the story of rock and roll.
I will give them a credit that they put Bad Brains on that ballot 5 years ago.
They did, I'm sure it got about two votes. You know what I mean? So
Dave Grohl and someone else.
Yeah, probably Tom Morello. Yeah.
Or just go back to Weezer to put a bow on that.
Sure.
Is that I think they'll get on a ballot within the next 5 years. I can't they see better. Them not getting a nomination. I mean, I think with the 90s, they're going to run to the problem where I think they're sort of not sure who to go with. And now they're like in the 80s, like how they were with like the 70s in the last decade. I feel like they're going to now go embrace every 80s artist. Now it seems on the ballot for the foreseeable future. And then maybe a 70s artist or a 90s artist here and there. But I don't know. I feel like in the next 5 years, they'll get a nomination. Maybe Soundgarden, I think, is going to reappear sooner or later.
Understand that one at all. They're a cool band, but like they don't why? You know what I mean? There's so many more important bands that like Soundgarden rocked, sure, but like they're just a band. Like, they're just a band with a good singer and a good guitar player. And like that was good enough to get a lot of bands in the 70s because that's all music was. But like there was so much more cooler stuff happening in the 90s.
Right.
That Soundgarden felt like a dinosaur even then.
Yeah, it's just, I think because they were more influenced by the blues and like, you know, like.
They love the blues in the Rock Hall.
Oh, they do.
I'm sorry, rather they love white people who love the blues at the Rock Hall. That's what they love.
The institution that has Eric Clapton as a
fucking, oh, don't remind me. That guy can jump off a bridge. So And he's not a Joe Walsh. And yet Joe Walsh is only in one time for the worst band he's in, right? Put Joe Walsh in three times. James Gang rules. Joe Walsh solo rules. We're switching the episode. I'm doing a Joe Walsh episode.
Deal.
He's the only member of the Eagles worth keeping.
Before Don Henley solo, which I think might happen to at some point.
Oh, God.
But might. It might. I don't know. So
all she wants to do is dance and make romance. What a terrible lyric. Oh, it sucks.
Oh my goodness. Well, Scott, I have appreciated hearing your takes on the Rock Hall and of course your knowledge, your deep knowledge of Weezer. Well, Scott, thank you so much for coming on the show and for all of the listeners who like Weezer. Hopefully they enjoyed this episode.
I hope so too. And if they didn't, that makes sense too, because I love and hate Weezer. So I get it.
That love-hate relationship.
It is. It's every day.
Where can they find you on social media?
Sure. You can go to @ScottHeisel, ScottHeisel, on literally every platform that you can have a social media account on. I pretty much have those locked down. I pretty much only really use Twitter. I use Instagram to post like records and my dog. That's about it. But yeah, find me on Twitter, engage with me, tell me I'm wrong or right or whatever. I also have a newsletter, Colors of Insomnia, which you can find at colorsofinsomnia.substack.com. It's free. I can't imagine ever charging for it, but maybe someday I'll make a couple bucks off it. I'll buy a ticket to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony to see Weezer in 2072. We'll see.
I think it's going to be much sooner than that. Come on. Like it's going to happen soon.
Sure.
You guys can, of course, follow the podcast Twitter account, which is @RockandRetroPod, and also my personal account, which is @NickDBambeck. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We need reviews to help listeners discover the show, and we just want to hear your feedback. Thank you so much, Scott, for coming on the show. We hope to have you again sometime soon. And thank you to our listeners for checking us out. We'll talk to you guys later.